So it's a great privilege and pleasure to have a chance to talk to Professor Takamiya, who, if I may, I will address as Toshi, as he is known universally after that. Toshi, when and where were you born?
I was born in Tokyo in 1944, actually the 23rd of February.
Tell me something about your ancestors, as far back as you would like to go. Most people usually say something about their grandparents.
Yes.
Who they were, their character, their occupations, that sort of thing.
Yes. My family had lived in Hokkaido for some time, since after the Meiji Restoration. Until then, Hokkaido had been more or less a separate island from the mainland. And I think the ancestors of my family were encouraged by the government or the Meiji Emperor to move from somewhere deep in Nara Prefecture, close to Osaka, to somewhere in Hokkaido, in the mid part of Hokkaido, because of their ancestors' contribution to the imperial family in the 16th century or something. Which is almost legendary, but they took the chance to go up to Hokkaido. My father's grandfather used to be a Shinto priest in Hokkaido. And my father was also given university education to become a Shinto priest. And he became a Shinto priest, indeed, before the war. But after the war, kind of he changed his business.
Which war is this? This is the First World War?
No, the Second World War.
Yeah. Your father, yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Hmm. And did you know your grandparents at all?
Yes, I knew my grandmother on my father's part, and also both parents on my mother's part. And on my mother's part, I think they went to Hokkaido somewhere from mainland. I'm not quite sure about the place. But my grandparents on my mother's side used to live in Otaru, very flourishing port town.
Yes, we've been there. Yes.
That's right, particularly before the war. Thanks to the Japano-Russian trade. And my grandfather used to run a kind of trading company to import timbers, lumbers from Siberia, in which he was very much flourishing. But after the outbreak of the Second World War, I think all the ships and aircraft were kind of confiscated by the army, so he became very poor. So soon after the Second World War, he decided to send my father, for instance, to Osaka area to start a new business. And he making a remote control from Hokkaido about his business.
So what was the new business?
The new business was to sell Japanese sea weed, kobu, to the Osaka area merchants. Because of the war, in Osaka area, there was virtually no food and very bad condition in terms of the availability of the food. And you may have heard, or you may have tasted, the shiokobu, salted seaweed, which is a specialty in the Osaka area. But you really need raw sea herb or seaweed coming all the way from Hokkaido. And my grandfather, since he had based in Hokkaido, he could supply my father so easily. There are quite a few raw material in Hokkaido, which he went selling to the very well-established salted coal merchants.
Mm.
But my father admitted that it was a very difficult task for him to do because he was a beginner and he was not known to these merchants at all because of a very Japanese kind of insular character. You really ought to be well established to each other. So he had a pretty difficult time. And also, since he had dealt in the raw material sent from Hokkaido on a cargo, that kind of things, I think he was once spotted by the occupational army for the use of a cryptogram in his telegram ordering things. And my first recollection, my first recollection of my father was the scene in which he was using a telephone, sending a telegram saying just odd things, B for Bob and D for Dick or something like that. Very curious to me when I was a child.
Did he go on with this occupation throughout his life? Or
No. I think I went to Osaka with my family at the age of three, and my father went on doing this kind of business only 5 years. And then probably he was summoned to go back to Tokyo by my grandfather. So we all went to Tokyo.
And then what did he do?
He kept helping my grandfather's business in the trading company. All sorts of different things like pawn shop and running a tea room, those kind of things. And then sometime later he decided to launch what is called a cram school, in which he succeeded to a great extent as a kind of educationalist.
And that cram school is just behind this house where
we're
sitting.
That's right, yes. So he launched this school when he was in the early 40s, and as its managing director, he died at the age of 92, 52 years of managing directorship, which is absolutely phenomenal.
What sort of person was he, a character? Was he a disciplinary or withdrawn or easy person or what?
Well, he was a family man coming home, but I didn't know very much about his business attitude. I thought he must have been very kind of austere, strong-willed person in business matters. And his model was the Japanese army in which he was involved. He was sent to a kind of top military official school in which he excelled in every possible academic discipline. He was very proud of this. He did far better than the University of Tokyo graduate and so on. So on its graduation he was selected as a top member of the headquarters. So he wasn't given any chance to go abroad, I mean to Siberia, China, Korea, in which many soldiers had to die or suffer terribly. But he was confined to a rather comfortable place in the in the headquarters. So his motto was study hard. He insisted to our children, to my brother and myself.
Are you the older brother or the younger?
I've got one younger brother. So we were all scolded by my father. Study, study, study. Terrible father.
Terrible father in that. Very disciplinary.
Very, very disciplinary. His model was anything which he learned in army school.
What about your mother? What was she like?
My mother was brought up in a well-off family because of my grandfather used to run the very big or successful trading company in Otaru. My mother once said that their house has got no performance stage in the garden, so that every summer, for summer holidays, many Tokyo actors and musicians of no drama came along to Hokkaido, staying in their house as guests for a month or so. So that was a very good training sessions which she was able to receive. And so my mother and also my father used to chant with no songs and playing no instruments. So I think my mother must have lived a very happy girlhood days. And just before the war, they got married, and I was I was their first son. And she was again, oh yes, still now she's very punctual. Punctuality has been her forte. Yes, particularly in eating times. She insists that we should eat lunch at 12 noon and evening meal at 6 o'clock. Still now.
You mentioned the No Theatre.
Yes.
And that they could perform some of these. One thing that I'm particularly interested in is your interest in medieval, Arthurian, and magical, and fairy stories, romance, and all these, or romance, all these things, which suggests that you had a childhood which had strong elements of this magical, mysterious world around you. And No obviously has something, some element of that. I was wondering whether you thought either the No or whether your mother was interested in reading you children's stories, fairy stories, or anything like that. Or you encountered that.
On the absolutely opposite.
Opposite.
Because you see, after the war, we had no time to go enjoying no performance or anything like that. Just the family doings. So I don't think I was influenced by my mother's interest or my father's interest in no performance. Anything like that. And also I was not given any sort of discipline, any lesson in Japanese music instrument or anything like that. Once they invited my father's old mentor from his own school, who was also very good at chanting. So after dinner, they started chanting no songs endlessly, which was really terrible for us. You know, we were forced into a bedroom and listening to this
wailing.
What appears to be a huge noise, not music at all. I was appalled on one or two occasions. So definitely, I was not influenced by my sort of parents' interest in music or Japanese art, which is odd, but in a way it is interesting, because soon after my re-entering Keio University for my second BA degree, I was asked to accompany the Hoshio No Troupe to go to the United States for 50 days, during which we did 35 performances, and I was an interpreter. Although I didn't know anything about no play, no performance, it was a hilarious, wonderful experience for me to learn something about the Japanese medieval drama, costume, singing, and so on. Because Professor Donald Keane, a famous Japanologist, was the organizer and host of this, I think, first visit of any no performers to go to the United States and Mexico City. And I accompanied them all through the 50 days of the itinerary. Splendid, wonderful occasion for me to learn. So my kind of education in things medieval and Japanese
started then.
Started later.
I'm always looking for traces in early childhood. What is your first early memory? A full memory. I mean, not just sort of trees waving in the sunlight, but experience. An experience.
At the age of three, as I told you, we all went to Osaka from Hokkaido, there was virtually no sort of ferry service between Hokkaido and mainland at that time. So my father managed to find a small fisherman's boat for him to come accommodate us. And there was a cat on the boat. And I think I remember it. That was my first memory of of my sort of Japanese life.
Your first school was therefore in Osaka.
Exactly, yes.
At the age of 5 or 6?
I was, seven.
Seven.
I was not given any chance to go to a kindergarten, so I started my early education at a primary school at the age of 6 or 7, I can't remember. And then spending 2 years in that primary school, we moved to Tokyo, where I was put into a public primary school. So my first encounter with a Japanese school in Tokyo was my accent, Osaka accent. I would say sensei, but in Tokyo you have to say sensei. So there's a different pitch. Whenever I called my teacher sensei, all members of the class will burst into laughter. I was hurt. I think about a month. And also, they use a different kind of vocabulary, which I wasn't familiar in the Osaka area. If the schoolmate say, "Oh, he must be rich," he would call Odaiji. Odaiji means a minister. You see? He must have minister in Japanese, in Tokyo dialect. I couldn't possibly understand. So these bits and pieces of different vocabulary had made me realize that, oh, there are different stages of the language, even in Japanese. And since then, I became bilingual, kind of bilingual. Going to Osaka, still now, I could use rather vulgar Osaka dialects, particularly enjoying drinks in the bar and so on. And I could command a Tokyo standard dialect. So I think this, what do you call it, realization of the different kind of dialects, not social but regional dialects, between Osaka, which has been very flourishing commercially and close to Kyoto, very long tradition, and new metropolis Tokyo, has given me some good sense of language.
Do you remember what you were enthusiastic about or interested in at that stage? Any hobbies or
baseball?
Yes,
I love playing baseball. You know, sort of childish way. And my father kindly enough to give me a proper bat and mitts and balls and even a uniform with a New York Yankees logo. I was very proud of that. Yeah. So I think almost every day I went to play baseball with neighboring kids.
And you've continued with an interest in sport since then, rugby and...
To a certain extent, yes, but not playing, but watching.
Yes. So, and aren't you a patron or an advisor or something to a rugby team?
At Keio University.
I was shocked to see that Keio defeated Oxford in when you first went with them to on a tour.
In the presence of a Crown Prince. We beat Oxford. Wonderful. But we were beaten by Cambridge. That was a heyday of Cambridge.
Was it?
Yeah. Bob Andrew, Gavin Hastings. I'm very proud to see the Cambridge 15s with the very best members of the team. And we were too quick to get the first try. Only 3 minutes after the kickoff, we got the 5 points. Mm. And then they became serious. So we were beaten. But Lord Butterfield was there.
Was he?
We had a wonderful time. Yeah. I volunteered to accompany the touring team as an interpreter. Yes.
And are you still a spectator of sports? Do you?
Yes, yes. I go to a rugby stadium, also a baseball stadium sometimes. Yes. And in my high school days, I used to play badminton. And our school was very strong, private and famous for success in competitive entrance exam of university. Still, we are very strong. And in our years, we were the representative of Tokyo area as the top of the champion. And we were sent to an inter-high school championship. So I went there with them as a manager, playing manager.
So this was your high school?
That's right, high school. Yes.
Well, which high school was this?
Azabu High School.
Azabu.
Yes, if I may say so, Azabu High School has been one of the most prestigious, good high schools. And rather nice for very sort of lenient school rules. Virtually no rules. We made all sorts of merry pranks, practical jokes. Good days.
Was it, you were a day boy?
Yes.
Yes.
Although, yeah, it's not a dormitory. No, it's not a boarding school.
Do you remember any of the teachers at that school particularly inspiring you?
Well, I think every member of the school loved teacher painting, Japanese painting, who was a recent graduate from the Tokyo University of Fine Arts. And his father, his grandfather, also very famous Japanese painter. But this one came to our classes making jokes, laughters, all the while. Because you see, in other serious subjects like English, mathematics, we are really supposed to be serious studying and so on. So, but this Japanese art painting class, wonderful for relaxation and exchange of jokes. He allowed us kind of merry pranks. Yes. And he became very famous as a Japanese painter later in his life.
And do you paint yourself?
I don't, and I didn't very much, but I love kind of Japanese drawing very much, copying insects from the encyclopedia. But I wasn't good at all. I had no artistic talent, which I regret very much. Although my mother was very skillful in sort of painting and embroidery, making the Japanese dolls, cooking, in everything. She was brilliant, but no, I have no talent.
What about calligraphy? You collect calligraphy, or at least you're interested in it.
Well, I had to learn Japanese calligraphy in schools, primary schools, and junior high school. But no, I wasn't good at all. No. But going to England much later, at the age of 31, I was fascinated by Western calligraphy, particularly Italic. So I didn't learn it from teachers or in schools, but I kind of imitated it. And I think I excelled at it to a certain extent. So whenever my Cambridge friends, English friends, saw my calligraphy, Japanese writing italics. it was a very good endorsement on their part. I love it.
What academic subjects were you best at or most interested in at school?
In primary school, I was very good at language, the Japanese language, and also social subjects like geography, history, not scientific subjects at all. Particularly, I remember I was the first to remember all the names of prefecture in Japan. I was really the first, which I am very proud of. And also, I was very good at reciting the textbooks and so on. So,
very good memory.
You to have a certain extent, yes.
You don't have a photographic memory.
No, I don't think so.
Because I think M.R. James must have had more or less.
Well, he's exceptional. I can't make any color.
Well, you know, for recognizing the patterns. And,
Oh, yes. I'm pretty good at it on my reflection. Yes. Mm. So, when I entered the Azaba High School, I remember in the very first lesson of music, music teacher asked me to read some paragraph from the textbook music on Beethoven. So I sort of read it aloud, sonorously. And he was simply impressed. Oh, what a good voice! Why don't you go and be a sort of TV caster or announcer? I was very pleased to hear that. Because in my school days, I really wanted to be a broadcaster myself.
What about music? Were you? Did you learn an instrument?
Well, I wanted, but I was prohibited by my father to get indulged in such a kind of popular pastime. Sports can be all right, but not music. So, even if I wanted my father to buy me a guitar, no, he said, no. Why don't you go and spend that time in studying or learning the spelling, that kind of thing. So only after my entry to Keio University, it was more kind of leisurely time, I started the piano lesson, which I liked, but by that time, my ear was so musical that my hands couldn't follow my ear. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I had to abandon.
But you listen to a lot of music, do you?
Absolutely, yes. I was not given any sort of influence, family influence at all. Although my mother was brought up in a very good family, she learned how to play piano and also listen to records and some classical music. But, well, we had no time to listen to it. But all of a sudden, at the age of 12, for my birthday present, I asked my mother to buy me Beethoven's the Fifth Symphony on record. She was kind enough to give it to me. I still keep it somewhere. It was a very good recording done by Toscanini. But our music, the record player, hasn't got any LP level, just the SP and so and so. So I had it broken instantly. I still keep it for my sort of very deeply heart heard experience. But since then, I was very, very fond of classical music.
You were mentioning the
yes.
interest in classical music or love of classical music. Which classical music? I mean, as a medievalist, do you like medieval music? And
my interest in medieval music came much later. In my high school days, I loved listening to a resounding sound like Berlioz, Symphony Fantastique, or Richard Wagner. I love Richard Wagner. Still now. And so, I spent many hours listening to live broadcasts from Bayreuth, Festspiel performances. And I think my high school days were divided into three parts, like studying in preparation for the entrance exam, and playing badminton, and listening to music. So I was not given any influence from any members of my family, but I naturally became interested in classical music, which still now I'm very fond of. Yes.
Do you think it's an obvious connection with Wagner and Parsifal and their whole ring with kind of medieval themes? Do you think that was...
Yes, or differently.
That influenced you?
I graduated from the Faculty of Economics first at Keio University, and then I went to the English department for my second BA. And already in my economics student days, I was fully interested in Wagner, and I was given a couple of chances to go to the United States as an exchange student. So on every occasion, I went to the big record shop to buy a complete set of Richard Wagner's, which started just coming out under the direction of Sergei Shosty. Tremendous sound, you know. I was fascinated by Wagner. And naturally, I got to learn the contents and background of Richard Wagner's music and his idea on the theatre. So, I instantly learned that some of his heroes in the music drama were Arthurian characters, Parsifal, Tristan, and so on. So, when I re-entered the university for my English disciplines, I really wanted to do something on Arthurian or medieval. And I happened to discover Satmas Malowitz Mazdala. And my supervisor, Fumio Kuriagawa, was the first Japanese translator of Malowitz Mazdala, which was just published. So I read it in Japanese translation first, and I went to see Professor Kuriagawa in his office, and I wanted to tell him that I'd had to choose Thomas Malory for my BA thesis subject. And he says, why not? And also, I shared with him our deep interest in Arthurian paintings by the Pre-Raphaelites. Yeah, Dante Gabrosetti, Burne Jones. But at that time, there were virtually no good colour illustrations in art books. Sometime later, they were just popped out.
I mean, this is the obviously one of the most interesting keys to your life. What made you so deeply entranced by medieval society and its later resurgence in the Pre-Raphaelites? I mean, funnily enough, when I started my DPhil, the three subjects I chose were witchcraft, marriage, and Arthurian legends.
Oh, really?
So I was deeply in love with all that sort of stuff. Tolkien was just coming out, C.S. Lewis was around, and so Oxford was filled with this kind of enchantment.
Golden days.
Yeah, so I sort of know the feeling, but it's very difficult to put it into words. I mean, how would you try and explain your attraction to that world?
Well, reading all through the text of Malory's Mordgatha, I encountered some interesting feeling, which is reminiscent of the Japanese samurai hood. For instance, giving an obituary on the death of Lancelot or Gawain. He was a wonderful knight so-and-so. reading these obituary passages, I almost cried into tears. What a thrilling Japanese-like emotion, which could share with the English feudalistic society. I didn't make any deliberate comparative study between the Japanese and Western chivalric romances or anything like that, but I think deep in my heart was the basic concept that we can share some sentiment of samurai and chivalry. In other words, the sense of honor and dishonor, shame, I think that kind of element is very strong in Japanese samurai writings, as much as in Maori. Much more than any sort of other French Arthurian romances. So this kind of sentimentality attracted my attention very much.
Do you like Tennyson?
Tennyson, yes.
Mort d'Arthur?
Oh yes, Tennyson, Swinburne. T.H. White.
T.H. White, yes. Oh yes, I'm a fan of T.H. White too.
Yeah. Humorous, and very knowledgeable.
Yes, I'll tell you later a story about T.H. White which you'll like. But were you also seeing, or had you read Bushido by Nitobe?
Yes.
Because that has this element of chivalry and
exactly, that's right,
Christian
yes.
mission.
Yes,
and
but that kind of book I read a bit later. Well, sometimes soon after I started reading Arthurian literature seriously.
And you've emphasized the sort of chivalric side of it and the feudal order and so on.
Yes.
Did the other side, the kind of magic and the faerie, as they put it, you know, F-A-E, that element interest you as well?
Exactly.
Because that links in to the Japanese kami, no shamanic side, the enchantment of Japan.
Exactly.
And many people think, of course, like T.S. Eliot, that the disassociation of sensibility and the breakdown of the medieval world vision was the end of enchantment. And do you think there was anything in your feeling that Japan was now a very sort of practical modern society and you could, through this literature and art, go back into an enchanted age?
That's an interesting question. As far as I'm concerned, one of my earliest publications on Mallory was The Origin and Role of Morgan le Fay, the fairy mistress.
Yes.
In which all sorts of interesting discussion has been done already by anthropologists, historians, and literary historians, particularly a kind of Celtic goddess, which can be traced in the region of Morgan le Fay. I think it was just picked up more recently in the successful fantasy called The Mists of Avalon. There's all sorts of women characters appearing in Mallory are more sort of dominant figures. Yes. So in the same sense, I think in the present age of fantasies, rather than realistic novels, well, partly thanks to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, even the many Japanese young generation, pessimistic on the future, would go to romantic world in the past, medieval past, where, well, I don't know how much kind of shamanism, the primitive structural society is pertinent in the minds of the younger people. But I think psychologically, quite often they go back to the medieval world.
I mean, a parallel way, or another way of going into it, which sometimes overlaps, as with Tolkien, is through children's literature, and you mentioned T.H. White.
Yes.
Are you a great reader of fantasy worlds of children, Ursula Le Guin, or C.S. Lewis, or these sort of authors? Do you like, enjoy those?
Oh, yes. That's right. And my students, who are much younger than me, were able to enjoy reading all these English romance literatures in Japanese translation at an early age. I think at the age of 10, 12, 13. And they would keep their interest in Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, to the university age, which is very nice. And I remember one of my former students, who is now professor of English at Keio, became thrilled by Tolkien's fantasies. And coming to Keio University, she read Beowulf for the first time seriously in Keio Graduate School. And she told me, all of a sudden, these bits and pieces from the Tolkien come from Beowulf. She was overjoyed. It's these discoveries. So, I should always emphasize the fact that these discoveries will be made only at Keio University, where medieval tradition is very strong.
Well, that's probably a good point at which to return to your life. I mean, leaving school, you decided to read what subject at Keio when you first went there?
Economics, yes.
Was that because economics was what your father and grandfather were interested in, or?
In that period, if you are good in human sciences, you are supposed to go and study economics. And if you are good in sciences, you are supposed to go to read either chemistry or physics, or computer sciences. So I chose economics naturally, but I was not interested in economics at all. Back in the 1960s, still some influence of Das Kapital in Japanese translation was everywhere in the economic department. So we naturally went to a bookshop and bought an entire set of Das Kapital in Japanese translation, of course. But I couldn't read many pages and abandoned it. And modern economic theory, Keynesian so-and-so, didn't attract my interest very much. So, for my BA thesis, I wrote something about the post-war agricultural problems, agricultural economic problems in Hokkaido area. So I went to do some field study in Tokachi, playing. Yes. So not very theoretical. I'm not very sort of good at the theoretical analysis of the economic problems, but so I decided to do field research.
But your heart really wasn't enormously interested in it. And what shifted you, and what point? Was it just at the end of your first degree you happened to go into a bookshop, or what happened to make you shift?
I find it very difficult to justify myself in this particular question. I am ashamed to say that my answer will be simply, since there is no good job available in the world on my graduation from economics, I wanted to remain in the university, on the university campus. Because you see, we had a very successful Olympic Games in Tokyo back in 1964. And after that, all the economics sort of slumped. And 2 years later, when I graduated from KM, there was virtually no good job available. Although I was suggested by my supervisor to go and see the KM graduates in a big company for advice and so on. But some of them told me very frankly, if you got some very keen interest in other things, there is no point of you coming to a Mitsubishi company. You know, they're too big, and you must work as just one of the very small cogwheels. So I was impressed by my sort of graduate's comment. So I thought about it. What subjects can I do better than economics? And obviously I was very much interested in English. Not English literature, but sounds of English. I remember without any deliberate attempt to sort of make my English sounds articulate, I noticed that my English should be all right, sound all right, so in comparison with other Japanese students. So I really wanted to do English phonetics, a kind of scientific analysis of the English language. But there was no such course in the English faculty. And then I happened to attend Professor Kuryagawa's lectures on medieval English literature. It was fascinating. I was thrilled.
So that then you were converted, and and you did your PhD, your first PhD on Mallory, and
I wanted to do Mallory, yes, but at that time in Keio University there was virtually no system of taking a PhD. As much as the University of Tokyo, still now. You see, it's a very strange tradition. So I didn't get any sort of PhD. When I was in the first year of the PhD course at KM, I was invited to be as a assistant lecturer in English department. So I took it up, and 3 years later I was given a chance to go to Cambridge, thanks to Dirk Boers.
You went as a Fukuzawa scholar, was that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I was given a very generous Fukuzawa scholarship, memorial scholarship.
Tell me your first impression when you came to Cambridge. Do you think you'd walked into the Arthurian world of the Ring?
I thought I was lucky to come to Cambridge for real academic research on Arthurian literature, particularly.
This was 1975.
Yes. Dirk Brewer was giving lectures on Mallory, and Jill Mann, a very young woman scholar from Oxford, but she's been giving lectures on Mallory. And I think, yes, Professor Brewer once proudly told me that he was the first to introduce into English syllabus Mallory's Mortlach. Because in Cambridge, Mallory's Mortlach was criticized and denounced by Roger Ascham. Since then, there was no one took it up for serious subject study. Well, he was joking, but I could stand. So he was the right kind of person to reintroduce Mallory.
Well, you had a very long and productive association with Derek Brewer.
Yes, indeed.
Tell me something about him as a person and your relationship.
He was a man of ideas and generosity, particularly to young students. He carefully listened to your students, and start giving good advice, where to go, what to do, and how to do it. He's a man of practicalities. His launching of a publishing firm is one example. He wanted to publish the young PhD holder's thesis, which even the university press would decline to publish. So that was a heroic deed on his part. And I remember him as the man who likes young people, mature, sophisticated young students. He certainly didn't like all the young students coming up to him for supervision, because one of my colleagues at Darwin College, the Danish mature student, who's been doing Lancelot legend in all European languages, because as a Danish, she's well versed in various languages, but she couldn't get on with them, which puzzled me to a certain extent. But now I can tell that she wasn't as kind of mature, sophisticated person as Derek expected to be.
And was he a great scholar?
He was a great scholar. There was some criticism that he hadn't published any sort of magnus opus. But his work on Chaucer within the social historical context has never been done by any other scholars in his in the 1950s and so on. Still, I think philological tradition was very strong in English department. So working on Chaucer meant that making a philological analysis of Chaucer's grammar and sounds and so on. But his interest in Chaucer went towards the literary, social, historical analysis, or placing Chaucer in the context in which he excelled. And his first book on Chaucer was kept being published with quite an extensive revision. So I think the same topic with extensive revision was published and republished as a magnus opus. So he was a very good scholar of Chaucer and Mallory. I was very much attached to his notion of Gothic Mallory, Gothic Chaucer. There has been a very strong controversy between the two schools of Mallory scholars on the unity in Mallory's Modafa, whether Mallory wrote unified Arthurian story from the birth to death of King Arthur, or whether he wrote 8 separate romances loosely connected at different times and put them together as the end. So this is why you could detect all sorts of discrepancies and strange things, like Tristram was a very fierce fighting knight, while his birth was recounted much later. All sorts of discrepancies were not ironed out. So there had been a fierce discussion on unity, particularly in Mallory's Modafinil, but generally on any medieval literature. Has been going on for 10 or 20 years or so, until person became came along with a very nice theory of being Gothic means. He says, look at the Gothic cathedral. The medieval cathedral has got a Norman element, or even Anglo-Saxon, Norman, Romanesque, and the top of the tower has got a Gothic spiral things, which would go towards the heaven. And obviously, artistically, I mean, art historically speaking, there's a lot of discrepancies, misconceptions about that. But any medieval traveller exhausted after the day's walking along the highway and byway, when he reached the top of the hill, looking at the town, what a wonderful cathedral architecture he will see as an absolutely total unity. This is the nature of Gothic. I love that. And since he introduced that kind of interpretation, there has been no discussion on unity.
That's very good.
Yeah, even in Tolkien's trilogy, you could find some discrepancy. Simply because he didn't dream of making totally unified story from the beginning.
I mean, there's some of this in Ruskin, in the Stones of Venice, the idea of the Gothic as a unification of contradictory forces, which are balanced and creative, but they're not unified in the classical mode. So it's very interesting. We'll talk further about that afterwards. I wanted to perhaps take you on now to, I mean, you were working on texts, but it must have been around this time that you decided that, or conceived the idea that maybe you would build up a library and maybe even collect the odd manuscript, Takamaya, number one. So how did that happen?
I didn't see any Western old book bound in leather until the age of 24. Just ordinary books, plus bound. One day, back in 1970-71, when I went to Isetan department store in Shinjuku, there was a small bookshop of Yushoda. They've got headquarters in Yotsuya, but they opened a new kind of pilot shop with lots of interesting antiquarian books, leather bound. I was fascinated. I didn't quite realize the fact that I could buy these books with a bit of money. So I bought. Ah, but I didn't buy this leather-bound copy on my first visit. I bought one of the Robinson Brothers antiquarian book catalogue of wonderful books and manuscripts which came from Sir Thomas Phillips. That was my acquisition number one. I think last September I celebrated the 41st year of my book collecting. Book collecting, I mean, the Western rare book collecting. Although I started collecting Japanese books at the age of 12. So, for the last 40 years or so, I've been collecting Western books, particularly on medieval English literature and early English antiquaries books, English Chronicles, the Raphaelites. So I've been interested in things medieval, and also I've been interested in later reception of the Middle Ages and medieval literature, so medievalism. Even before the day when the word medievalism was being used. One of the aims of my collecting Western Korean books was to use them in my teaching classes. Because with the real books for my students to see and touch, they could learn more about old literature and old culture. So, I did two things at one and the same time. I started buying books for my own collection as well as for recommending to Keio University Library. Now Keio has got a very good collection of reference books as well as some real manuscripts and print books, even catalogs and so on. So we should be very proud of holding them, but we should not remain as the guardian of hoards. We have to make them easily available to students if they are interested. So I should always encourage them to go to the library, grab a group, to study them. But before that, you really ought to be well disciplined. So I've been giving classes on paleography, historical bibliography, codicology, that kind of thing. So I'm very pleased to see some of my former students now very well trained.
Where did you learn paleography?
I learned paleography from Professor Kuriagawa in Keio days, and medieval Latin too. But on my visit and stay in Cambridge, I learned paleography first of all from David Dunbar. As well as Professor Brewer, I was supervised by Ian Doyle, the Downing man, who happens to be the rare book librarian at Durham. And he was also a supervisor. And he was wonderful in historical bibliography. I learned a great deal. And I got on very well with Richard Beadle, young fellow at St. John's. And Malcolm Parks from Oxford came to Cambridge quite often for lectures. And I went to see Neil Kerr in Oxford. I went up even to Edinburgh, Pitt Lockley, to stay with him in his house. And we kept talking of manuscripts and books. I learned a great deal. So I was very fortunate in having this kind of network, which I brought back to Keio.
And tell me about your first encounter with a manuscript.
Yes.
You mentioned your first encounter with a book. When did you first buy a manuscript and why?
Soon after I started frequenting the usual bookshop, I think they brought my attention to this 13th century Parisian Bible. And I was fascinated by this and I bought it. Rather, I twisted my father's arms for it. And I told you before, although he was very strict about my sort of buying anything for entertainment or anything like that, but he was very understanding in my sort of serious academic positions. So he has been very supportive in books and so on. Roughly at that time, there have been many Keio professors who went to either Cambridge or Oxford on sabbatical leave. And on their return, they started talking about the importance of manuscripts for scholarly research. So, I found it a good thing to collect manuscripts for my own pleasure as well as for teaching. I started letting my PhD students use my collection for their PhD work.
You mentioned your father helping you.
Yes.
To buy the first manuscript, but
not all of them.
You've bought over 100 manuscripts now, and
that's
you
right.
have a wonderful
yeah.
book collection.
Yes.
And I don't want to sound rude. You say somewhere that you're no Getty, and you're no,
no
Rothschild or whatever.
No,
but the collection you have is obviously very valuable, and even when you bought it, it must have been very expensive. Surely a Keio University, your university salary is the same as mine, roughly, and I couldn't begin to buy one shelf of the books that you've got there. Was this family money, or?
Yes, indeed, yes. And also I think I was wise in spending money. I don't claim I was very good at making money. Well, that's why I'm an academic now. But I was fortunate enough to find some means to buy them my own library. And also, I started collecting
early.
Middle English manuscripts much earlier than anyone else. Because talking about manuscript, your automatic reaction would be, oh, beautiful wars and missile, that kind of thing. With pictures, lavishly painted pictures, I can't afford to buy them, and I'm not interested in pictures. So plain looking, shabby manuscript, as you say.
But with wonderful associations, signatures of William Wordsworth and things like that.
Yes, exactly.
I heard the stories from Tim Munby of the days when David's bookstall used to. Buy books in the London sales and then put them in John Maynard Keynes, and all the book collectors in Cambridge used to rush down on whatever day it was, Wednesday, and fight for the... And then they were sort of sixpence or a shilling for some really wonderful book. And that had all changed even by 1975.
Yeah.
But you really only started collecting in the 70s, didn't you?
Right, yes.
So it was still... It was beginning to get expensive, certainly antiquarian books.
Oh, yes. But... with expertise, experience, and knowledge. Yes, knowledge is by far the most important element in collecting. I got on very well with, for instance, David McEttrick, now the librarian of the Trinity, and David Hall. He used to be a number two of the English Library. We got on very well with each other because more or less we are in the same generation. And every now and then we got together weekends for book hunting expedition by my car, going to Oxford, going Hay-on-Wye.
Yes.
And they are very sort of wise and shrewd in choosing the right kind of books. Just by watching them, how to sort of maneuver into ramage through the bookshelves. I learned great too. And their emphasis was always on association copies.
And you presumably spent time in some of those wonderful old libraries like the Parker Library and the Trinity Old Library and Keyes Library and saw all these leather-bound books on the shelves. Had the sense of what a beautiful library was like.
It would be wonderful to have that kind of atmosphere in my library. But as you see,
we are
suffering from the housing problem.
You need a Duke Humphrey to come along and...
that would be wonderful, yes. There was one occasion about more than 20 years ago when I moved out of this place, bought a kind of land and house. With a library installed underground, air sort of conditions entirely, that kind of thing. But the designer of architecture firm gave me some estimate. With that very expensive money, I thought, oh, I could have bought more than 12 manuscripts. So I did just stay on here. So I think many visitors here from the foreign countries, Hans Krauss and others, were rather shocked to see how small my house is, my library is. But by Japanese standard, no, this is huge.
Tell me a little more about your teaching, because I've read several accounts which suggest that you, as you mentioned, you like buying books for your teaching, but you had many students who write in your Festschrifts and draw attention to your unusual teaching methods, not only your style of lecturing, but also the way you organize your seminars and so on. Teaching has obviously been important for you. You've enjoyed it. And tell me how you teach graduate students, perhaps, particularly, but any.
They always make a complaint about the fact that although I should give them a hint for a certain question or a certain hint for a new research area, I don't always give them the right kind of answer to them, and they are puzzled. They have to go to the library to work out. I think that was my way of teaching. If you give a good question and then explain the answer,
there's no point.
There is no room for them to do research. So I shall keep my mouth shut, or I can't find answers myself. So I would suggest to them, why don't you go and study them and give me back with the right answer? Well, this may sound a bit shocking to you, but I think in Japanese university no one has done that kind of teaching. Because, well, if I may say rather candidly, all the Japanese professors in Western subjects would read very assiduously the great authorities, George Steiner, Wittgenstein, and kind of things, and put into Japanese and make it easily understood in their own, or make it deliberately difficult for the students to understand. I don't like that idea. I think my teaching style has changed drastically after my 3 years stay in Cambridge. How to make them think?
Well, this sounds
well,
like...
Well, this is your spirit, isn't it?
This is what I was talking about in my lecture.
Yes.
I mean, it's a totally different approach, isn't it?
I think so.
And I am right in thinking it's very unusual in Japan to make people think in that way, with confrontational discussions.
So, in order to enhance this kind of teaching style, I invited lots of distinguished academics from, particularly from Britain and from the United States, for our lectures. But under the ordinary circumstances in Japanese universities, we would invite Professor McFarlane to give a lecture on his own. But virtually no feedback from the students on. I don't like that idea. So in my own seminar, if you are invited to my seminar, certainly I should let you talk as a keynote speaker or so and so. But beforehand, you would kindly give us your text, which my student would read in advance and make a critical account of it. And I should make them read papers. Thus, exchange of all sorts of interesting observations, particularly since you are making a comparative account of Japanese and Western university systems. This is inevitable. This is all we need to discuss. So even in medieval English literature or bibliographical studies, I shall hold the small seminar with three or four speakers. One is a very distinguished British scholar, Lotte Hellinger from the British Library. But I shall let my three PhD students to read their own paper. And often she will be impressed to see how extensively the Japanese students here, long away from Britain, doing the right kind of things, which even the British students don't touch on. So they kindly call my school as a sort of Tosh school, which is very unique. Even going to the international conferences, they would read very unique papers of it, which is very important. I think I learned this side of the discipline from Patrick Boyden, the Italian scholar, at St. John's, the Dante expert.
Because you were at St. John's, right?
Yeah, exactly. He emphasized the importance of being a good Dante scholar in Britain. You must choose the right kind of topic on Dante which no Italian Dante scholar would dream of, and put it into a wonderful presentation in which you have to use Italian more fluently, more eloquently than the Italian scholar. So I shall make every attempt to read a paper on Caxton and Mallory. In the very minute way of handling the bibliographical matter, which British scholars would never dream of, and I shall read it in a way, more kind of a British way than the British people. Particularly going to the Kalamazoo Conference of the International Medieval Congress. So many Americans would be very surprised to see a Japanese chap talking in a very British way on a very British subject. But very interesting. I think this is how we ought to do, which I learned from Patrick Boyden.
Well, we're coming towards the end of the time and the tape, but it's always a fragmentary life that one presents. And I always ask people towards the end if there are any subjects about which I should have asked them, things that they would really like to have talked about a little. We've covered your teaching and some of your research and your childhood and so on, but are there any other things that you really would have liked me to ask you about and talked about?
I have been a bit worried about the lack of interest among the undergraduate students in the real books. They are content by rummaging through or surfing the digital images for the right kind of information they readily put into their own paper without seeing the real books and so on. So, for the last 5 years or so, before my retirement, I started giving my undergraduate students the library guide and also antiquarian book guide in the Jinbucho area, the Cherenkos Road in Tokyo. And all of a sudden, some young students get interested in all books. You see? And some of them would go to the American bookshop twice a week and finding a wonderful book.
Hmm.
Yeah, with a signature of Walter Pater with yes. some notes on it, and very cheap because the shop owner don't know anything about it. That's a very good start to be a book collector or a bibliomaniac. And then I have launched what is called the Keio University Society of Bibliophiles by organizing a lecture and a book auction on a very humble scale, because we are, so professors have got lots of duplicate copies to dispose of easily, and they'll be put on auction, and the young student will come along and bidding it. Exciting things, isn't it? And they're very happy with the new acquisition, so on. And my, probably one of the future urgent desiderata is to launch the Keio University Book Collecting Prize, as it started in Oxford, Cambridge. So I'd like to keep the good book collecting tradition at Keio. Keio has produced a very good collectors in Japanese classic literature, Chinese classic literature, and Western. Professor Kuriagawa used to have a very good working collection of Middle East literature, which has ended up in Keio. And so on. So how to drive young undergraduates to get merged into it.
I think I read a rather nice story about you when you were at Darwin.
Yes.
And you were asked to pay some university fees or teaching fees, which you shouldn't have had to pay.
That's right.
And Eric Brewer intervened and persuaded the senior tutor that you really didn't need to pay them.
That's right.
So you won your victory, but what was nice, of course, was that you then gave them the money. The same amount of money for the Tim Munby.
That's right.
Fund. That's a very delightful, charitable.
Yes, and on the following day, I was a hero. How generous Toshi is, yes.
Lovely.
I never dream of that reputation. No. I think what I did was just
a rather Arthurian chivalrous gesture.
Well, yes, Lancelot offering £1,000 to the Maid of Astolat.
That's very nice. And the last question I was going to ask you, you mentioned your retirement, and as someone who is retiring this month as well, you've just retired earlier, what are your plans now for, as I hope, our best and most productive period of our lives?
Yes. After my retirement, as you go to teach at Keio once a week, but no meetings, which is wonderful. And very soon we are going to launch a new portal site called timewithbooks.com on the internet. And I have been made as the editor for the Mail magazine. This site, Time with Books, will encourage particularly young people to go and see the books in the bookshop, library, and touch on, fondle them, smell them, for the pleasure of holding books, possessing books, and so on. So this is meant to be for young librarians, booksellers, even laymen, positively interested in books, and so on. So I'd like to make it as my last mission to encourage young people getting more interested in real books, as well as much as the digital images. I've been interested in making digital images myself, but
Lovely. That last mission reminded me of Lancelot, or Parsifal going for his last adventure. Mm-hmm. So I wish you all well on that adventure, and thank you very much indeed
for
a lovely interview.
Yeah.